Barbara, you've spent most of your career writing about problems of class and gender and inequality, and this was after you got a PhD in cell biology. And I think anyone who's followed your career would have pegged you as a very secular and rationalist thinker, probably someone hostile to religion. And yet now you've written a book about mystical experience. Did you feel like you had to come out of the closet to talk about these experiences you had many years ago?
Oh, yes. That's exactly the image I would use, because these are things I never talked about. From the time the strange things happened to me, I realized that these could be interpreted as signs of mental illness. So it was better not to say anything to anybody. And it's a big leap to suddenly be publicly talking about things so far beyond my usual purview.
So you didn't even talk about this with your family?
Oh, no. Are you kidding? The last people I would talk about to. No, my parents were very dogmatic atheists. I'm an atheist also, slightly less intolerant one. But they would have mocked me, I'm sure. There was no way to talk to them.
Hmm. And then later on, I mean, after you came of age, I mean, there were decades when you presumably were mulling over all of this. You didn't want to go there? Were you worried that you were going to get laughed at if you talked about this mystical experience you had back when you were a kid?
Well, laughed at or diagnosed, you know, patronized in some way at worst, institutionalized. I didn't know, but it just seemed to me that since I didn't have good words for it. See, I didn't have language for it. And that was a big inhibition, too. I won't use terms like spirituality. That's a fairly empty word. And it pretty much creeps me out. So I didn't want to fall back on that. And I certainly was not going to call it an encounter with God, because there was no indication in my experiences of a God, and, you know, that just didn't enter my mind.
Okay, so take me back to your adolescence when you started having these very unusual experiences. How old were you when they started?
I guess it all started when I was 13, although you might say that the door was opened when I was even younger, around 12, and decided that my mission in life was to find out the truth about everything. Why are we here? What's the purpose of this? What's going on in this universe? And I thought I was the only one who would ever ask these questions. At least I couldn't find anything in the library that helped. I tried just about every kind of subject, too. So I thought if I just really concentrated hard and was very, very logical, I could probably come up with the answers in a few months, which was actually way too optimistic.
So I think a lot of kids, teenagers, have those kinds of questions. I did when I was that age. But then you said that the way you write about this is you had what you describe as perceptual adventures, as if a layer was peeled off of the world.
Yes, and I don't think any of this is unique to me or even that unusual. But starting when I was about 13, there would be these moments, maybe more than a moment at a time, I don't know, when suddenly a layer would seem to peel off the world. The layer that contains all the words, the language, the meanings, the human significance of everything, that would go away, and I would just be left looking at whatever mundane objects I was looking at, but they were no longer adorned with abstract meaning. It seemed like I was seeing things, quote, as they were.
So this is, I mean, something you were seeing. I mean, this was a visual thing that was happening, not just something you were feeling.
No, I don't imagine. I can't recall that there was any particular feeling attached to this. I think for some people there is, because I now understand, just through fairly recent research, that there's a word for this. It's called dissociation, or even dissociative disorder. And I was surprised to find a support group on the internet for people who, quote, suffer from these incidents and just want things to be normal again. Well, maybe it didn't happen to me in the same way, but I just thought, well, that's interesting.
You did not feel like you were suffering. You found this to be rather intriguing, these kinds of things.
Yeah, I was interested. I was curious.
Well, then, skipping ahead a few years, this stayed with you, kind of this sort of response to the world. And then when you were 17, you had a big experience, a mind-blowing experience. Can you set the stage for what happened?
Yes, and I should say that the phrase I finally learned to describe such an experience is, quote, a mystical experience. Not my favorite words, but, you know, there we have it. And this started, well, in a skiing trip. I was with my little brother and a high school friend. We drove from Los Angeles up to Mammoth Mountain for a day of skiing and spent the night before with an uncle and aunt who lived not too far from Mammoth Mountain. We were supposed to go stop skiing and just drive straight back to Los Angeles, but for reasons I could no longer recall and only figured out very recently, we didn't go home. We spent the night in the car in the town of Lone Pine, California, sleeping in the car. And I woke up, or if I ever slept much at all that night, a little before dawn, went very quietly out of the car so as not to wake up my companions, and started walking around in this strange town. And I think maybe it's better to read a little passage here from the book.
If you could, yeah, because I know you spent a long time thinking about how to describe this in words. So, yes, if you could read about this.
Yeah, I mean, I can't do better now than here. So in the next few minutes on that empty street, I found whatever I'd been looking for since the articulation of my quest, or perhaps, given my mental passivity at the moment, whatever had been looking for me. Here we leave the jurisdiction of language, where nothing is left but the vague gurgles of surrender expressed in words like ineffable and transcendent. For most of the intervening years, my general thought has been, if there are no words for it, then don't say anything about it. Otherwise, you risk slopping into, quote, spirituality, which is, in addition to being a crime against reason, of no more interest to other people than your dreams. But there is one image handed down over the centuries that seems to apply, and that is the image of fire, as in the burning bush. At some point in my pre-dawn walk, not at the top of a hill or the exact moment of sunrise, but in its own good time, the world flamed into life. How else to describe it? There were no visions, no prophetic voices, or visits by totemic animals, just this blazing everywhere. Something poured into me, and I poured out into it. This was not the passive, beatific merger with the all, as promised by the Eastern mystics. It was a furious encounter with a living substance that was coming at me through all things at once. And one reason for the terrible wordlessness of the experience is that you cannot observe fire really closely without becoming part of it. Whether you start as a twig or a gorgeous tapestry, you will be recruited into the flame and made indistinguishable from the rest of the blaze. I stopped at some point in front of a secondhand store, transfixed by the blinding glow of the most mundane objects, teacups and toasters. I could not contain it, this onrush. The dream I had had the night before in my uncle's house had been right about that. Nothing could contain it. Everywhere, inside and out, the only condition was overflow. Ecstasy would be the word for this, but only if you're willing to acknowledge that ecstasy does not occupy the same spectrum as happiness or euphoria, that it participates in the anguish of loss and can resemble an outbreak of violence. At no time did I lose physical control of myself. I may have leaned against a building at some point, but I never fell down. Whatever else was going on, whatever cyclones raged in my brain, the neuromuscular system remained functional throughout.
So as you were having this experience, was it more scary or exhilarating?
I can't say, because you have this ecstasy combined with or alternating with something terrifying. as I said, it seemed to be about loss at the same time that I seemed to be gaining everything and seemed to have the answer to my questions about what is going on, why do we exist. But I had no words. I felt I had a kind of an answer, but no way to say it.
And you go on to describe this as if you'd been savaged by a flock of invisible angels, lifted up in a glorious flutter of iridescent feathers, then mauled, emptied of all intent and purpose, and pretty much left for dead. I mean, it sounds like a shattering experience.
It was shattering. And it took me some time to unearth the immediate aftermath of this experience, because it was hard to think about. And the journal that I had kept when I was a teenager is very evasive about this. At one point, I'll say, I can't go on. I can't go on. I have nothing left to do in this world. Everything is now ugly and empty for me. And at another point, I'd be saying, I want that to happen again. I want to get back there. So it took some detangling to figure out how to describe the sort of shattered aftermath.
And you describe this as an encounter with a living presence. What made you think that?
That was a subjective feeling. It felt like there was something there. Now, I didn't think that was a very sane conclusion, so I decided to go with the more conventional type of explanation that I'd had some sort of little mental breakdown or malfunction, and it wasn't even worth mentioning to anybody.
So that's the way you had sort of written it off in as you sort of constructed the narrative of your own life. Okay, I kind of had this little psychotic breakdown, didn't last long, but let's forget about it, let's move on.
That's right. Not until middle age did I begin to return to this and find myself asking over and over again, since I turned out not to be crazy, I mean, not terribly crazy, have lived in many ways a normal and I guess a psychotherapist would say, quote, healthy life. You know, it made me think, well, maybe there was a kind of encounter. Maybe I should explore that strange possibility a little more.
So why? Why did you think that this was, I guess you could say, real, you know, not just kind of a sign of mental illness? Why did you conclude that all these years later?
Well, I didn't fully conclude it. But it began to inform other work I was doing. It began to, as a question, spill over into, for example, what I was learning about the history of religion for various other projects. And to understand that so much of religion had begun with experiences that seemed to be not unlike mine, that had this dual aspect of being thrilling and terrifying, that were overwhelming, that often seemed to involve the image of light and of flame.
Who were you reading? Oh, was this the Christian mystics?
Well, first, I gave a little thought to the Old Testament. A lot of the Bible was new to me. You know, I didn't know about these parts, and I just tended to dismiss it. So in the Old Testament, you find many of the prophets wandering in the desert, usually, and it is the desert that seems to be most conducive to this kind of experience. I also read some of the Christian mystics, and my focus on the Christians, which means Europeans in most cases, Europeans, is that they tended to write more. They're pretty prolix about their experiences and put them in a subjective context often, like perhaps one of the most famous is St. Teresa of Avila, whose autobiography was an account of, wow, she had a lot of these kinds of encounters in her life. She saw them as encounters with the deity and usually described them as full of love. But there is a hint of something else. She also talks about them being somewhat violent, somewhat being somewhat destructive. And I bear in mind that she wrote her autobiography for the Inquisitors to read. So, you know, that she was being careful not to say anything that might be too crazy sounding to the Inquisitors.
Right. But from your account, you do not describe this as any encounter with God.
No. Don't you think if there was a God part of this, there would be a face or a voice, some commands, some instructions, some... No. Nothing like that.
Now, the fascinating thing to me as I read about your story is that you still call yourself an atheist, even though you're describing this really powerful mystical experience.
Yeah, and I guess this is a good test of my atheism, right? I think everybody who fancies himself an atheist should go through something like this. And many atheists have. One of my favorite examples is Virginia Woolf, who was very rationalist and secular, and she was made a little nervous, ill at ease, by these mystical experiences that occurred to her.
I'd never heard that before, that she had had mystical experiences.
Well, either you can tell in her fiction, too. It comes out in books like Mrs. Dalloway. At least I can see it there.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, I mean, the other thing about atheism here is if I had any sense of an encounter, it was not an encounter with anything good or benevolent. It was way strange beyond anything like that. And the religious world we live in now, for the most part, in our era, is mostly monotheistic, in which there is one single deity, at least for Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, who is perfect and perfectly moral and good. Now, that kind of annoys me, because if there is a deity who's in charge of it all, I would like an explanation from him or her about a lot of the things that go on in the world, and not just cruelty humans inflict on each other. But the violence of nature.
But I think there's a more common understanding of atheism. I guess a lay understanding is it's an atheist is someone who doesn't believe there's any non-material dimension to reality. There are no otherworldly beings, nothing supernatural. That's not your definition of atheism.
No, I don't think so. In fact, I think it would be a big mistake and has been a big mistake for science to rule out the existence of non-human consciousness and will and agency in this world and perhaps in the universe. Well, we always allow for extraterrestrials, so I shouldn't say that. But here's a mistake. I think a pretty large mistake on the part of science for the last few hundred years, which was to promote the idea that non-human animals are just dead mechanisms, just objects. It's only in the last 25 years or so that their scientists have satisfied themselves, although there's still a lot of debate about this, on the subject of non-human animal consciousness. That there are animals, you know, who think, imagine, who are altruistic, who are very creative, even artistic. And so that dividing line between the grand human and the non-human animal world has been broken down. But that was a serious mistake on the part of science.
But there's still a big difference between, even if we acknowledge that animals have consciousness, they have active minds, there's a big difference between animal consciousness and, you know, what you described as being savaged by a flock of invisible angels. I mean, that's a whole other dimension that we're talking about here.
Yeah, but what if animals could talk? We don't have enough language in common. So I'm not going to say right now that I am all that much more spiritually or intellectually elevated than a bird.
Yeah. So basically, it sounds like you're describing yourself still as an atheist, but not as a strict materialist.
No, I want material explanations. Let me give you an example of that kind of thing that sort of inspires me to think this way. And that is the discovery of the creation, I should say, of the germ theory of disease in the 1800s. Now, if you went back before Pasteur and several other important people in this story, most intelligent people would have said that diseases, contagious diseases, are caused by God or are caused by mists in the air, bad air or something. If you had proposed in, say, 1820, that the diseases like cholera were caused by little tiny creatures that just happened to be invisible to us, you would have sounded crazy. That would be nuts, right?
Right.
And yet that's what Pasteur and others were proposing, that the causes of many of diseases were animalcules, little animals, as some of the first people to look through microscopes put it. And it turned out to be true.
So then to come back to the mystical experience, what you're suggesting is maybe there is some physical explanation. Maybe somewhere down the line, the laws of physics can explain this kind of mystical encounter, and there are, we might call them spirits, but maybe there's some physical substance to them.
Oh, yes, there better be some physical substance. Though I would remind you that actually most of what is matter, M-A-T-T-E-R, in the universe is not the familiar kind of matter that we can see right now. It's dark matter. So you don't drop rationality when you come to something like that. You don't say, oh, well, that's a beautiful spiritual mystery. You keep on going. We need to know what dark matter is. We need to know if, on the chance that there is something conscious or conscious-like that contacts us in these, quote, mystical experiences, we better find out what it is.
So you do believe that there's some kind of consciousness that exists outside our individual brains?
Yes, and I think I mentioned animals. Interestingly enough, fascinatingly enough to me, that the discussion is among scientists has now wandered over to plants. You might have read the fascinating article by Michael Pollan in The New Yorker a couple of months ago about the debate beginning about whether plants have memory and awareness, even altruism, which ought to make vegans all be a little less smug, I would say.
Right. Well, play this out for me. I mean, and again, it's worth reminding our listeners that you have a PhD in cell biology. I mean, you're not exactly just shooting from the hip here, but speculate on this. You're saying that our science is too reductionist. It's too bound by its own sort of definitions of materialism. Where else might we go to try to explain the kind of experience that you had?
I think I'll stick with science and keep pushing on it to not be so as blinkered as it has been, say, in the case of non-human animals. And look at the changes that have gone on in physics, for example, in the last century. The introduction of quantum physics. And let me just say, I get very upset when people try to misuse quantum physics to kind of justify whatever spiritual notions they have. But nonetheless, this was very shocking to me when I first learned about it, the idea that subatomic particles are not exactly locatable, or if you do know where they are, you don't know how fast they're moving. You can't know both at once. Or that they can be in two places at once. Now, that philosophically really did set physics back on its heels. What have we been assuming about the world, and does it work that way? Another example I think of, don't ask me to explain either one of these in any depth, is the more recent discovery of chaos theory or nonlinear dynamics, whereby, for example, patterns can emerge out of chaos, out of what looks like a mess to us, underlying patterns in the world. It's very popular now to talk about the emergent qualities, for example, of the mind or the brain. So, you know, things have been moving along, and I would not say it's like science, you know, it's like rationalism versus mystical experience. I'd say let's bring our rationalism to the mystical experiences.
Well, and there are some big name philosophers and even some scientists who talk about panpsychism, sort of this idea that there is this consciousness that kind of permeates all of reality, that it is in itself a fundamental principle of reality that may be not reducible to the laws of physics.
Yes, and I have been sampling some of the scientists who've come to think this way. I would, and I'll give a pretty amazing example. I don't think he'd call himself a panpsychist or anything, but I think it's Freeman Dyson who said that since an electron or other subatomic particle, most movements cannot be predicted. They're determined by something, but we cannot predict them. We might as well talk about them as having free will. Now, that sort of changes the texture of the universe when you begin to think of all of these little dances going on at levels we can't see.
Well, the other tradition that you write about is animism, which is very common among indigenous people, tribal people, the idea that everything is alive. I mean, not just people,
yes,
not just animals even, plants, you know, maybe even other things. And it sounds like that kind of resonates for you.
Yes. If I were asked to pick a religion, I guess I'd say animism, if it even qualifies as a religion. It's a little different from pantheism or panpsychism because there's no God part in it. It's just about, it seems to speak to my experience of a world flaming into life. Now, here's where I have a big, big problem with monotheism. The rise of monotheism globally is usually seen as a very progressive advance. You know, that people were becoming better, you know, more logical, whatever. But the rise of monotheism has also meant the crushing of most indigenous religions on Earth, very actively crushed in like 18th and 19th centuries, imperialism, global imperialism, where, you know, priests and missionaries accompanied the colonists, and their job was to wipe out any prior ways of seeing the world.
So coming back to your own experience then, I mean, this is so interesting to me. Your attempt to try to make sense of what happened to you when you were 17, it sounds like you're saying that you didn't have the vocabulary to describe it back then. You didn't almost have the imaginative capacity to, but it was only, you know, going back and reading about the history of religion, reading about mystics, about what scientists are saying about animal consciousness, you could start to put this in some kind of perspective. Is that fair to say?
That's right. And it took a while. And then it took a while after that to even begin to acknowledge to myself that this is what I was doing. This is one of the things I was actually working on. And, you know, my journal from my teenage years played a big part in this because that meant I had a primary source in trying to figure some of these things out. I couldn't have written this book if I didn't have that source.
And yet, the vast majority of scientists out there, at least what they're willing to say publicly, is, you know, this is just brain chemistry that we're talking about here. I mean, this kind of stuff, there's no actual living presence out there. The science that, you know, that we read about in the New York Times is just not really going to go to where you're going right now.
Well, what I have trouble with in that statement is that this is just neurochemistry, et cetera. Yes, I think that a mystical experience must have a neurological and biochemical correlate. You know, that there's something going on. I wish I knew what. I wish we had, you know, some way of understanding why the brain suddenly, you know, goes off like that. But that's just a correlate. The subjective experience is still there. Like, if I can talk to you, I could talk about love, for example. Love can be pretty well explained in terms of neurochemistry and neuronal firing channels and evolution and so forth. But that doesn't say anything about the subjective experience of love. Right. We know those are two things.
You're really saying it's time for science to open up, and it's time for kind of theories of knowledge to expand, that we've become much too narrow in our culture.
Well, yes, and what I say to people now that I've written a book and come out, I say that I understand that a lot of people have these experiences. They never talk about them, in most cases, probably for the same reasons I didn't. But I say, if it happens to you, if something like this should occur to you, and you see this magnificent, transcendent presence in your life, do not fall on your knees. Remain alert. Take notes. Get a blood sample if you possibly can. You know, for all the special effects, we should look through that. There's not any reason to revere or be in awe of something so strange. There's a reason to investigate.
But I'm wondering if, in trying to make sense of this, whether it would be more useful to approach this within the framework of religious experience rather than trying to explain it through science. I mean, because as you say, mystics have written about these kinds of things in various religious traditions. Is that a useful course to take?
Oh, yes. And I'm fascinated by those mystics who have made an attempt to really explain or understand what their experiences were. One of my favorites is actually one of the better-known Christian mystics, Meister Eckhart, from the 14th century German monk, who he didn't talk with, it wasn't so much in the first person, but he talked about encountering a God who is not good, who is just utterly different from ourselves. And things like that, you know, it are very encouraging to me to read, because then I could say, all right, I think this guy, you know, he was onto this way before I was.
Well, and you're also pointing to the tradition of awe, or some people have called it the sublime, which is, it wasn't just wonderful, it's terrifying too. Kind of the two go together, the wonderfulness and the terror.
Right. You know, there's a biological kind of example that when we talk about our hair standing on end or having, I think the German phrase is a heilige Schauer, a holy shiver. It's of fear and awe and amazement all at once. Yes, we have the capacity wired into us to react to certain things like that.
Sounds like you're probably a fan of the great psychologist William James, who thought experience rather than belief is what mattered in religion.
Yes, I had read much of his book, Varieties of Religious Experience, but only in the last few years read the crucial chapter on the mystical experience. Here he was around the turn of the 20th century, kind of beginning to create a database of mystical experiences by interviewing people. He has long, long narratives, not pages, but long narratives of people, what happened to them. Some of these people were non-believers, some were religious Christians, but he recognized the commonality in these different experiences. And he was the first person to try to curate them a little bit.
Which raises the question, going back to what you said earlier, that probably the kind of experience you had is not that uncommon. I mean, it's not as if people have these every day, but lots of people have had really powerful, really weird experiences, but they don't really talk about it. And the question is why? I mean, why is this kind of taboo to talk about in our culture?
Well, several people have written to me, or even longtime friends have told me since reading my book that they, too, have had experiences like this. The Pew Research Center once did a survey and reported back that something like 49% of Americans have such experiences. Now, I don't know in that latter case what that means, because I've heard people describe a nice dinner in a restaurant as a, quote, religious experience. So the language is a little bit of a mess here. There's also, I think, the whole New Age movement tends to, like organized religion, sort of suck these things up for itself and claim them for itself.
And you're kind of allergic to anything New Age or even talk of spirituality.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I want to keep it rational. That's
but it's not rational. The whole thing you've just been talking about is not rational.
Yes, it is. Let's not drop our rationality when we confront the bizarre or the weird. Let's keep right on thinking.
Do you think will science ever be able to explain the kind of mystical experience that you had?
I like to think so. I don't know if it'll do it fast enough for me, but I would like that kind of molecular and cellular materialist explanation. But I really want some openness to the possibility of non-human consciousness that can contact us. And, you know, one of my sources here, just so I don't sound completely crazy, is science fiction. And I know that's not science, but it's science fiction that for, a half a century, more than half a century, has at least entertained such possibilities, but in a kind of rationalist context. One of my favorite books of that sort is Arthur C. Clarke's book, Childhood's End, in which a mass mystical experience, well, it starts out individual, becomes massive, turns out to be inspired by another being, something that Clark calls the Overmind. And what its purpose is, we don't find out. But as soon as the Overmind has engineered this vast psychic experience among humans, it blows up the planet Earth and destroys us and goes on, I guess, to find a fresh planet. I don't know.
That's a cheery thought.
So, I mean, that's a little, you know, I mean, science fiction always has held open the possibility of other beings not currently detectable by our instruments.
And then there are some major figures in science fiction, like Philip K. Dick, who has described having a kind of a mind-blowing experience not too dissimilar to yours.
Oh, yes. And he wrote and wrote and wrote about it. In 1974, he had an experience set off in, you know, it's not clear what set it off. It seemed, again, like, as in my case, a fairly mundane setting. And he described it as being, as that he said afterwards, he felt less like the Buddha and more like the victim of a hit and run accident. You know, then that resonates with me. He tried to figure it out. He invented this complicated Gnostic cosmogony, if I'm saying that word right, to explain it, with lots of different deities running around and competing with each other or reinforcing each other or something. So, yeah, I think there is a science fiction history here, which I hail and salute here, chiefly because it frees us up to think a little.
So, Barbara, do you think you're done with this episode in your life now? I mean, you've written this book, you've been talking publicly about it, or is this a subject that you will continue to investigate?
Oh, well, the subject, yes. What I'm really curious about now, and I'm not going to tell you whether this is going to be a book or what, but I'm very curious about cells in our bodies. I got that PhD in cell biology. If we thought of animals in those days as just mechanisms or objects, we thought of cells even more so, right? I mean, the cells, they're all supposed to line up and do what they're supposed to do within the body. Otherwise, we are in deep trouble, as in the case of cancer, which is a cellular rebellion. Unfortunately for all concerned, it ends up killing the cancer cells as well as the body they inhabit. And I'm interested in other more normal kinds of cells in the body and whether they can be said to have some sort of agency or mind. All right, sounds nuts, but already in the case of some of the immune cells, there is language used by people who study them, such as decision-making, such as chatter among the cells, such as memory by a cell. And we have a new form of microscopy now, which is opening up a lot more and enabling us to view the motions of an individual cell inside living tissue. So that's what's got me turned on now.
I'm going to stay tuned. I hope you do write about this.
Well, book I can't promise. We'll see what happens.
Thank you so much. This has been fascinating.
Oh, my pleasure. It's good talking to you.